On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Michael Lynch and Lane Hancock about free choice in early modern thought. So we cover all sorts of topics like just, you know, what are the contemporary intuitions that we have when we think about free choice? How does that map back on to early modern thoughts and conceptions related to it? How did the patristic and medieval era end up influencing ideas and thoughts about freedom and contingency and possibility and necessity? Are there broad consensus groups or camps that you find in the early modern period, particularly among the Reformed? How important was it for the early modern period to maintain a strong sense of divine freedom? Would they be okay with a modal collapse? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I am one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that is dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And in Thinking Seriously, we've tried to create or cultivate or encourage one of those things, an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, cheerful confessionalism. So really what that boils down to is not being a jerk to people and being open and hearing from them and saying, you know what, there's a lot of stuff to learn. I don't know everything and I want to hear about it. But also thinking as critically as possible. So we're not going to take the low-hanging fruit. We're going to go for the best arguments and understand all that there is that we can understand. So we have all sorts of guests on the show, all sorts of topics. It's a lot of fun. Today, I'm thrilled to talk about early modern conceptions of free choice and everything related to that. And this is probably the most well-prepared I've ever been for a podcast episode because I have two brilliant people with me here in Lane Hancock and Michael Lynch. So if you don't know them, you're going to get to know them. You're going to enjoy them. If you're a regular listener, you know Michael because he's been on the show before. We got to talk John Davenant, hypothetical universalism, and convincing everybody why we think John Owen might be wrong, or maybe he's right. I don't know. I don't have a strong opinion, but Michael, you were very convincing in your episode. So if you haven't listened to it, go take a listen. That was a lot of fun. So let's go ahead and get down to business. No one's here to listen to me. They're here to listen to you guys. So Michael, you've been on the podcast before. Why don't you just start? Tell me a little bit about yourself and what got you into thinking early modern period sort of research.
Yeah, so I work for the Davenant Institute. Actually, currently, I'm teaching a course on free choice. So this is an area that I've been doing a lot of reading about, not so much in like medieval or modern thinking regarding free choice, but particularly early modern discussions of free choice. And so I've just been interested in early modern theology for a long time. And so that's why I'm interested.
And you, Lane?
Yeah. First, thanks, Jordan, for having me on. And second, I appreciate how much London Lyceum has taught me while I do the mundane dishes and the chores and whatnot. London Lyceum has introduced me to lots of really fascinating people and expanded my theological horizon. So for that, thank you. My name is Lane Hancock. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Notre Dame studying moral theology, although my dissertation is on Jonathan Edwards. It is co-supervised by Jerry McKinney, who's a moral theologian, and Sam Newland, who is a philosopher. So I'm having to do a little bit of both and for Edwards' philosophy and theology, and really have been interested in this topic even before I chose my dissertation topic. I did an exam topic that ran chronologically through free will, free choice, divine will, divine freedom, and theodicy from basically Suarez to Kant. Obviously not every single figure there, but some of the main ones, Suarez, Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza, and obviously the early modern Reformed. I actually took Professor Lynch's early modern thought class, and we had a great time. So glad we could take the show on the road here.
That is awesome. I didn't know you were studying with McKinney. That's cool. I've read a biotechnology book or something. I'm pretty sure I've read that one. And I found it very interesting. So it's definitely not my area of thinking, but I enjoy exploring that sort of stuff. So maybe we start when we think free choice related things, we're talking, let's think contemporary intuitions regarding the topic and how early modern metaphysics might fit onto that or not fit onto that. So early modern thought on free choice, how does that really map onto how we think about it today?
That's a lame question.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that one. I think, so this is the throat clearing part of the state of the question, I guess. But one of the things that one of my professors said, which really strikes true, is if you want to get at, because there's such a plurality about metaphysics and ontology and like what's a cause, like some of the basic first principles in early modern philosophy, once you get outside of the schools, is just so up for grabs that one of the best ways of framing, of asking the same question, is to zoom out and ask, like, what are the conditions? What are the necessary and sufficient conditions for responsibility, for attributing praise and blame to a particular person? Because if you ask free choice about, if you ask whether or not somebody just hands up or down, does somebody affirm free choice or free will, you can pull the room in that respect, but you oftentimes will miss some of the subtlety that distinguishes, say, Descartes from Leibniz, from Spinoza. And these are all the outsiders, which we won't be focusing quite as much on. But just to say, generally, if we want to scoop up the most and retrieve the most possible conceptual distinctions for retrieval and for use today, it's probably better to think about this conversation as, when we think about free choice and free will, as a subset of a larger early modern conversation about the conditions for responsibility.
So before we get started more into it, would you have any potentially just general cautions when we think about it today? Because I know probably a good segment of our listeners are more Reformed or Calvinistic. And anytime I go on Facebook, I could see somebody who just became a Calvinist or whatever, and they've got this very simplistic understanding of what's going on. So anything that we should be conscious of as we proceed into this conversation?
Yeah, I do have a couple. I think to begin with, I think it's important to note that every theologian in the period, in the early modern period, excluding people like a Spinoza or excluding like some of the Socinians or something like that, they all have basic truths, fundamental truths that none of them are ever going to deny. So, like, they all believe God has foreknowledge of everything, of all future events. They all believe that God decreed to create this world with all of its events rather than some other world. They all believe that there's at least some dependence that all secondary causes have on the first cause, which means that they're all generally going to hold to some sort of divine concursus, right? And this excludes certain later developments, Lane, you know, kind of as we've been talking about this, right? So there are certain live options and there are certain not live options. So in 1650, among a Roman Catholic or a Protestant, a good kind of confessional one, right? Deism on the one side and occasionalism on the other are not really live options. One denying secondary causality and one basically saying that that secondary causes have no real kind of relationship with the first cause once the first cause creates, right? And so I think it's just important to remember that they're not asking every question conceivable or debating every question conceivable. They're debating and asking questions within a limited set of assumed truths that everyone agrees on, right? And so there are live questions and live options and not. And then I suppose the other bit would be that you should never presume that the ways that terms are being used today are being used exactly the same way by these early modern folk. But that's kind of an obviously historical question, and that rings true in any when you're doing history at all.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Go ahead, Lane.
Yeah, I was just going to throw in two more things. One is, determinism, libertarianism, compatibilism, all these terms are very frequent and come very quickly to the primary sources. And one of the things that we had discussed is sort of like not foregoing that or saying that these are anachronistic or that these like are somehow that the primary sources are should not and cannot be labeled. I think they can, but I think the pedagogically it's best to sort of work slowly through the complexity of these primary sources and let them sort of surprise you with the ways in which all the commitments that Mike just delineated might be fleshed out. And if I were to address myself, like many years ago, whenever I started thinking about these types of questions, I think the simplistic way to put it would be something like this. In the early modern period, this entire debate, Roman Catholic, Jesuit, Dominican, Reformed, Lutheran, Arminian, like whatever, wherever you are, the whole debate is a dimmer switch, not an on-off switch, right? So when I was much younger, I thought it's like either predestination or free will. The light is either on or off. But in reality, like if you read widely and charitably across all these sources, what you find is actually a superabundance of both ands, people inheriting this sort of Augustinian axiom that we ought to say yes to both divine foreknowledge and human freedom, and then thousands of models that sort of bloom out of a commitment to harmonize those things, which everyone in the field takes to be biblical deliverances. So the whole debate is a dimmer switch, not an on-off switch.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. So as we move into the early modern period, they're not in a vacuum. They've got patristic medieval sources that are informing their views, I imagine. What are those main who are those main figures? What are those main important axioms? Like you mentioned Augustine already. Is he the main figure? Is Thomas? Is Scotus? Who are the main players influencing just the discussion as we move into it?
It seems to me that it depends on when you're placing the theologians. So, the kind of first, second generation Reformation, generations, including the Roman on the Roman Catholic side, their sourcing is obviously coming from late medieval kind of theology. However, that's late medieval theology that has been filtering through either Thomas or basically there's kind of two streams. It's really the Franciscan Scotus stream or the more Dominican stream, right? Obviously. But once certain debates become really important, like the De Auxiliis controversy, this was a controversy in the late 16th century among Roman Catholics on the nature of grace and the helps of grace in Auxiliis. They really honed in on questions like free choice, and they wrote, massive amount on them. And it's really that discussion that really sets the stage for the high Reformed Orthodox period, and then the, kind of a higher scholasticism that's reading these earlier guys, like like Báñez, Domingo Báñez, or Diego Alvarez, and on the Jesuit side, I'm blanking on Fonseca is a guy, and some of these other guys, and then like Suarez comes onto the scene, and again, it really is Roman Catholics who are reading from, say Thomas all the way through the late medieval period into, and I mean Scotus as well, like both of those streams, Scotus and Dominican, coming in, and then you have the De Auxiliis controversy where you get this sharp debate between certain Jesuits and certain Dominicans who are being very careful but kind of going their separate ways on free choice. And then the Reformed Orthodox are just trying to enter into the debate insofar as what they think is biblical and true and faithful to history and et cetera. And so the main guys are, you know, we might say, you know, Scotus, Bonaventure, and Aquinas in the medieval period. There are other names that come up quite often. I mean, we were talking about, who were we talking about, Lane, the one that Suarez goes after.
Juanez?
No. He goes after, the on the other side, more like general causality, general divine.
Oh, Durandus.
Yeah, Durandus. Yeah. Right? You know, some of these other names are like guys that, these are names that often get entered into these such in these discussions. But once the De Auxiliis controversy happens, it's those guys who are really setting the agenda. Because the Jesuits have their guy, like Molina, right? And the Dominicans have Alvarez and Bañez. And then all the other discussion kind of really flowers from those guys. Because those guys are already aping from the early, taking what's, you know, necessary from the earlier guys and kind of expanding. Lane.
No, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'm done.
I wanted to back up a little bit and say, when I referenced the Augustine was arguing against Cicero that we should have to choose between one of these two options, namely that the gods for Cicero, but God for Augustine has exhaustive foreknowledge of future events and that humans have free choice. That's City of God 5:9. And it's sort of the paradigm by which the rest of the tradition walks. And so I just, it's taken me a lot of time to figure out how does this tradition work and how does it operate? Because, and this is one point in which I'm again speaking to my younger self about the relationship. There's more of a methodological point about how to get analytic philosophy and analytic theology stuff to relate to scholastic theology. So the sheer scale and scope of the scholastic tradition arguing about free choice is enormous. So here's a couple of stats. So Peter Lombard's sentences are four books that include 182 distinctions across almost 1,000 pages. That's the church's textbook for almost a millennia. And what it is a compendium of all these short sayings from patristic authors, very often tied to key scriptural loci. So insofar as Lombard is scriptural, the entire scholastic tradition continues to both return to him and to the biblical text. I mean, if you look at Aquinas' question on predestination, Prima Pars, question 23, almost all of the said contra authorities there are either pulled from Romans 9, or they're pulled from the late Augustine, or they're pulled from Ephesians 1 and Titus 2, 5. So this is a thoroughly scholastic but also biblical exercise that keeps building on itself. So from Lombard, you get Aquinas' Summa, which is structured into three parts, 614 questions, then subdivided into 3,125 articles. And so when we come to the Summa, and when we come to, there's less people that go to Lombard for lots of different reasons, there's lots of the analytic philosophers, analytic theologians who go to Aquinas, it is possible to write an entire book on just the second part of the Summa to the detriment of the first part, or like just ignoring it or bracketing it. So a lot of, I think what Mike and I are stressing in terms of like reading, bracketing intuitions about all the isms and reading as much as you can from the scholastic tradition before we come up with evaluative judgments of whether we like it or not, is meant to sort of it's meant to sort of correct for a picking and choosing. Like somebody will really like, you know, the Summa of the Prima Pars, but totally ignore the second part on free choice. And the devil's in the details in terms of figuring out, do these models of free choice and free will work? But the scale is something that tends to be very foreboding for students.
Yeah, no, it definitely feels foreboding at times. I am curious, as we've talked about some of the different schools, and I might be jumping ahead here, but I'm just curious, when you think about the early modern period, particularly in the Reformed camp, are they trying to be self-consciously faithful to various strands of the tradition when they're thinking about this topic? Or are they trying to be original and creative in some sense and saying, look, it's all been, we've missed the boat here. We need to go back to Augustine or something. Like the medieval period went astray, or how are they thinking about this topic?
I generally think that the Reformed Orthodox, they're much more cautious about some of the metaphysical discussions that are intimately related with questions that come up in free choice. So you will, LeBlanc, this is Louis LeBlanc. He was a French Reformed theologian from, like, let's say 1625 to 1675. So he's in this nice period right after De Auxiliis, and he's able to read Suarez and all these other people. He begins by saying that the Reformed generally spend a lot less time on some of the metaphysical questions related to free choice and are, we might say, more concerned with the theological questions related to free choice. So whereas you will find in a Roman Catholic early modern scholastic text them dealing with all these questions related to the nature of the will and the nature of the intellect and their relation between the two and these sorts of things, you will get Reformed addressing generally those sorts of questions, but they're more interested in, like, assuming that we have free choice, assuming that we have there's some relationship between the intellect and the will with regard to the an act being free and these sorts of things. They like to move the discussion rather quickly to things like, how did the fourfold state of man, how is the fourfold state of man related to that? Or how is free choice related to divine foreknowledge? And how does free choice relate to divine concursus? And how does free choice relate to the divine decree, right? So it's kind of the theological problems that they're interested in and the theological questions more so than the metaphysical ones. And they, I think it's fair to say that they let the Roman Catholics do that work for them. Perhaps the argument would better be said that the Roman Catholics did that work previous to them, because I think the important thing to keep in mind here, I was reminded as I was teaching this today, in fact, that a professor of metaphysics at a university, first off, these universities in these Protestant places are just getting off the ground. And so the very first type of faculty that they're going to have is theological faculty, because of course, that is what makes their schools, their universities, distinctive. And so the first thing will be is to put in a theological faculty. It is often the case that the philosophical departments don't get actually put in till later. Indeed, someone noted to me that it wasn't until 1640 that the University of Leiden got their first professor in metaphysics, right? That is, in part of it was because Utrecht already had one. So students that wanted to study metaphysics, they just go hear lectures over in Utrecht, and then they come back to Leiden and do their work at Leiden, and that was it. And so I think that this is kind of, novelness isn't something that is easily attainable when you don't even have a professorship for metaphysics, whereas you do at these old Catholic universities, and so they can spend all their time studying, you know, one discipline like metaphysics and writing on it. So Lane may have more to say about this. But.
I came prepared with exactly one hot take, and here it is. The most important metaphysician for early modern Reformed free will and free choice debates is a Spanish Jesuit. And what I mean by that is Francisco Suarez. So again, sorry, I promise this is also the last time I'm going to stat drop. But just the size of Suarez, his metaphysical disputations, like, needs to sort of like be put on the table so that it can be viewed in its proper, like, Catholic context. Like, everyone is using Suarez. Like, everyone is using Suarez's disputation on metaphysics. he Suarez cites over 247 authors across over 7,000 citations. The Omni Opera printing runs 2,000 pages double columned, right? So when this gets printed in 1597, as Mike said, every theologian who wants to know what's the nature of a secondary cause, sort of an anachronistic question, but nonetheless a relevant one, is they would have asked, like, how do you avoid necessitarianism? How do you avoid Hobbesism or Spinozism? How do you figure out the modal transfer argument? Well, if you go to Turretin, that's only 4 pages, and it's filled with distinctions, but you don't, and the distinctions don't, he sort of, like, you read it and you get the impression that the distinctions are, like, known quantities, and the reason for that is because he's relying on knowledge of Suarez. Like, if you want to get at the nature of necessity, if you want to get at the nature of secondary causes depending on the primary cause, Suarez is your man. And just to give one example of how, like, there's not the reformed view, like, singular on free choice. For my exams, I sort of worked through the generational adoption of Suarez's metaphysical disputation. So the first generation, I forget which Dutch university, it may be the one that Mike just mentioned, first generation just teaches straight Suarez, just teaches exactly a Jesuitical, air quotes, theory of secondary causality. Second generation teaches it as being true for, like, mundane acts, but not true for salvific acts. Third generation, the notion of physical premotion, which I'm sure Mike can define later on, comes in. And then the fourth and fifth generations that come after that splinter off into, like, Cartesian metaphysics and Lockean metaphysics. So what Mike said is true, absolutely, for the time period up to 1650s and 1670s. But once you get past that, once you get past Descartes in the 1640s, you have this super abundant blossoming of reformed metaphysical systems that go after Locke, they go after Descartes, they go after Leibniz and Wolff, they go off in all sorts of directions. So again, it is a hot take, but it's true. Suarez is arguably the most important metaphysician during this early time frame before the reforms start revising and building upon him. But it's all a collective Catholic metaphysical enterprise, except for the Socinians and the people who want to, like, deny divine timelessness and divine passibility and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I love convincing historian-related people to give hot takes. That's my favorite thing to do on the podcast. So if I'm going to push the knife in a little bit more, you've mentioned Suarez, you've mentioned Lombard is pretty important. In my own sort of, like, pop reform circles, those names aren't mentioned as we need to go read them and retrieve them. Why is that the case? Why is it always all 24/7? It's Thomas Aquinas. What, like, what happened to Suarez? What happened to Lombard?
Translations. You have translation of most of Thomas, and indeed we're about to have all of it. I mean, in the next 10 years, we'll have everything translated by Thomas. And access, right? It's easily accessible as well. Like, you can just look up Thomas in English and then you can find all the works just right there, right? Suarez is translated a little bit, not much, just a little bit, and it's in books that no one knows about, published by St. Augustine's Press in South Bend, Indiana. So only people from Notre Dame know about it.
Go buy the books.
Yeah.
Again, if you're going to have Turretin on your shelf,
indeed,
have right next to it Ferdoso's translation on efficient causality, Disputations 17, 18, 19, and his translation of Suarez on creation, conservation,
and
concurrence.
And then go get Ferdoso on Molina and divine knowledge.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, just absolutely brilliant stuff. So, yeah, I mean, part of it is there's no Latin, and then no one knows because no one reads in these sources to begin with. I mean, the person that's picking up Turretin, how many of them are tracking down the sources that Turretin? Yeah, exactly. So anyways, I mean, that's the bottom line is that Turretin's easily accessible for the reform person, but most of the other things he's quoting, that's not accessible to you unless it's like Augustine or something.
Yeah. So.
And so the Reformed metaphysicians that do exist, like Franco Burgersdijk or Adrian Hierbord, who were the metaphysicians for the following people, John Locke, Benedict Spinoza, and Jonathan Edwards, their writings are enormous because they're like Suarez plus plus. So it's 2,000 pages of double column print plus what Burgersdijk and Hierbord wanted to add on top of that. So there's a sense in which like just the scale, like you're, even if we sort of corrected the translation, which I totally agree, like unfortunately scholarship moves as quickly as the translations do, and the academy does not incentivize translations whatsoever. So that trend is not going to change. The conditions under which we would get like a resurgence in reform scholastic metaphysics would have to be, I don't know, there'd have to be some super, super rich person who's willing to endow a decades-long translation society towards that end.
We need Robert Barron's general metaphysics.
Yeah.
He was an Aberdeen doctor, hypothetical universalist, says out front, I agree with Suarez and Fonseca on general concursus. Yet this is a dude that holds to absolute predestination, reprobation. He's a reformed Anglican. Anyways, completely amazing, completely based. No one knows. He was known in the period. He was being read. Actually, he was read by like later, you know, like after it was published, like people cite him. LeBlanc citing him in France. But the book wasn't published in France. So like he got access to it somehow. So all that to say is that, you know, there are works out there. And that book's not too long. It's like 350 pages of Latin. You know, it's a general metaphysics. And but these sorts of things, where are you going to go to get metaphysics from a Reformed theologian in the early modern period? I'll wait while you tell me.
Francisco Suarez.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. And only that which has been translated. Right. Yeah. Which is only a little bit. So yeah. Anyways, or Penner or something like that, whatever he's done. So all that to say is that this is my point is that, you know, lots of these conversations are had without any awareness of like what these guys actually believed in metaphysics, because no one actually reads any of these metaphysicians. And then, as Lane said, once you get some of these major later 17th century figures, I mean, it like goes wild. And you know, and then Fuchsius spins pages going after Cartesianism and Cartesian metaphysics and stuff, right? Who's reading? Who in our Reformed world is reading Descartes' metaphysics? And then who's reading Fuchsius reading Descartes' metaphysics? Right? Like, there's just no. It's just there's hardly anyone, and so this world is wide. It's and wild.
Two sources, just so people don't have to take our like word for it over a podcast. I think the book that I recommended the most over and over again in my time at Notre Dame for people who were interested in this topic and were interested in like ecumenical rapprochement, like broadly speaking, but also just interested in like the exchange of ideas and exchange of gifts across traditions. The most important was Beyond Dort and De Exilius, which is it's unfortunately a Brill volume, super expensive, but at the same time, it's co-author, it's a primarily historical book, and it gives you, it's written by Roman Catholic and Protestant authors. I think everyone's a Muller student. Mike wrote a review for it. So that, first of all, that book is great. And then the second thing I was going to add, Mike mentioned Sidney Penner. For people who are like, you know, let's see what Suarez is actually up to, if he's worth all this stuff that Mike and Lane are hyping him up to be. You can Google Sidney Penner and Suarez, and you will get his webpage where Sidney is doing the yeoman's work of translating bits and pieces, and really interesting pieces on from Suarez's De Gratia, where there'll be questions like, does the will always to follow the last judgment of the practical intellect, and sort of all that sort of stuff. So there have been like strategic translations, but again, it's all thanks due to Sidney.
Cool. Yeah, Sidney seems super awesome. So, I don't know, years ago I was writing an essay and I didn't know what in the world I was doing. So I just emailed Sidney. No idea who he is really, other than he's like footnoted in some stuff I was reading. Super awesome. He's like replying with these massive replies, telling me all this stuff. Super cool. Keeping on, free choice, like we've mentioned quite a bit of terminology. I don't know. It probably makes sense to pause just a little bit and hit the timeout. So freedom, contingency, possibility, necessity, like diachronic, synchronic, contingency. I imagine most theology students who go and pick up a book like Richard Muller's Free Choice, or I don't remember the title, in Early Modern Thought or whatever it is, they start seeing these diachronic, synchronic stuff, and it's like, what in the world is going on? So maybe just help me, give me that lay of the land a little bit as we think about freedom and move forward towards thinking more just distinctive camps in the Reform period. Like, how are these terms being used?
So I would not start with Muller. Muller would be one of the last places I'd start with. The first place I would start, if this was a, let's say, a fairly well-educated, but someone who just hasn't really read anything in this field, early modern Reformed freedom or Reformed thought, like on free choice, like, what am I saying? What I'm saying is that you should go read Reformed Thought on Freedom, which is a book edited by some students of Antoine Voss, who was a philosopher, kind of theologian philosopher who wrote on Scotus, Duns Scotus. Anyways, that book is a primary source reader with a very nice introduction, as well as disputations from various authors, spanning from Zonkey all the way through the 18th century. Like, I think De Moore or something like that is one of the later ones. Anyways, helping you to get a sense of the way that these things are talked about by at least the Reformed. But to be honest, if you read them and you read the book carefully, actually, what you'll find out is that this is pretty much the way everyone talks, including the Roman Catholics, except, as I noted to you, that the Roman Catholics do more of the, they also talk a lot about the philosophical side of things, which none of these disputations do too heavily. I have my issues with Reformed Thought on Freedom. You mentioned synchronic contingency and diachronic contingency. I'll just say I've never seen it. In all of my reading of early modern theology, I've never once, in their discussions on free choice, even in their discussions of how free choice relates to divine foreknowledge or something like that, I feel like I've read a considerable amount. I've never once seen them ever make the distinction that the Reformed Thought on Freedom editors make between this, that there was Aquinas and Aristotle held to diachronic contingency, and that where in the kind of the principle of plenitude, where every possibility must be actualized. These are, I never see any of that discussed among the early moderns, and instead what I see are someone like LeBlanc saying Thomas and Scotus on their definition of free choice is basically the same. Literally, that's what they'll say. They do not see any major fundamental difference. They define it basically as freedom from coercion, and basically willingness or spontaneity or something like that. And so they are not seeing it. So whatever someone like Antoine Voss and some of the Reformed Thought on Freedom folk think about that story in the history of ideas, I do not see early modern theologians or philosophers saying that same story or recognizing that same story. That doesn't mean that the Reformed Thought on Freedom folk are wrong in their reading of Scotus and Thomas. It would just mean that none of the early moderns picked up on it, or at least self-consciously picked up on it, because I never see them addressing that as an issue. They never talk about time relative to a choice, except to say things like in actu primo or in actu secunda, or they'll talk about us having simultaneity of potency, but not potency of simultaneity. They'll talk about those sorts of things that are somewhat related to time. But apart from that, I never see them talking about the, you know, how Aquinas has this one view of choice that means that the possibility that in at any particular time you only have one option at any particular time or something like that, whereas in SCOTUS he allows you to have two options at the same time at any particular time or something like that. I never see them talking like that. And so I'm hesitant to say that. So there's my hot take relative to Reformed Thought on Freedom, folk. I don't know if Lane has more comments about that.
Well, I was just going to throw out, again, speaking to my younger self, you can actually get somewhat up to speed on all of the terms. I mean, granted, like, free choice is a name for something that many people can use in different ways. So that's kicking back to my, like, we're looking at conditions for responsibility, especially once you get out of the schools. But the reading list is actually not that hard. I mean, you start with Aristotle's De Interpretone. That's about 14 pages. Then you read book 5 of Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy about different kinds of necessity. So Aristotle gives you how do the gods know future contingents? What's the relationship between future propositions of value? And then Boethius comes in and sort of comments on that. And then the next place to go is Lombard book 1, Distinctions 39 through 41 on foreknowledge, predestination, and then like into the 40s you get into the divine will. And then book 2, Distinction 25 is after creation and on free choice. That Lombard there, we're at what, 40, 50 pages total just to get started there. And then once you have those figures down, Lombard's great because he has what's taken to be the authoritative sentences and pronouncements from the late Augustine on these topics. So by reading, I mean, obviously include City of God, book 5 here, but even if you put Aristotle, Boethius, Augustine, and Lombard together, as what I just laid out, you're looking at only like 50 to 70 pages, and like you're ready to go, and you're ready to get into the Summa and navigate the Summa by question and answer. Don't feel like you have to read all of it, but pick distinctions that are interesting to you. And then once you were to do that, once you basically get into Thomas, there's a certain sort of like synergy around him, as Mike said, he's been translated, and so there's been people debating about him. You're not going to find any scholar, any analytic theology scholars working out of Lombard. You will find tons working out of a Thomas. So if you get Aristotle, Boethius, Augustine, Lombard into Aquinas with that background, you can then sort of be a discerning reader of contemporary analytic theology and analytic philosophy. You can sort of decide whether or not you think Aquinas is a compatibilist or a libertarian. So that would be my short reading list.
So when I think about early modern reform period and their general views on free choice, take Turretin, for example, should I think along the lines of there are broad camps like the Roman Catholics think X, the Socinians think Y, and the Reformed have view Z? Is it that simple?
No. What is somewhat reliable is that Jesuits and Arminians typically agreed on their position on free choice. And generally speaking, the Reformed preferred the Dominicans on these topics. But I actually noted to you earlier on that Robert Barron, who wrote a metaphysics track, he explicitly throws his hat with the Jesuits on this. And so there's diversity within the Reformed. I'm sure that you could find some remonstrant who liked Domingo Báñez or something Actually, I really have that. I have a hard time believing that, but I'm sure it's out there somewhere. And so, yeah, so those are the lines. It's not Roman Catholic versus Reformed. It's really certain Roman Catholic theologians versus other Roman Catholic theologians, and the Reformed have the same issue just with regard to Protestants. And they're basically debating the same points among their own. And so, yeah, it doesn't work that clearly. That's more true.
Yeah, it's also worth noting that when we ask about free choice, we could be asking about it in two respects. We could be asking about it with respect to acts regarding God's salvation of a particular individual, or we could just be asking about mundane actions. So, for example, if you look at, looking at Suarez, he's addressing the latter, not the former. He's addressing like mundane, on the whole, he's addressing mundane sort of concurrence of God as primary cause with the secondary cause. He addresses issues on grace and auxilium elsewhere in other tracts. So this is really important because for Jonathan Edwards, for example, Freedom of the Will is primarily a philosophical book. He mentions predestination all of once, and that's in the conclusion about a book he'd like to write in the future. And that's actually not bizarre. That's pretty normal because there's two different ways of getting at it. And just because one theologian has a particular model about free choice for mundane actions does not mean that that same model is in play for divine acts. Thomas Aquinas, for example, has a very different account of how the intellect works with respect to the will in the act of faith than when he's just talking about mundane human actions.
Okay, so I've got to know, I'd like to spend some time on this, because when it comes to free choice, I look at a lot of the contemporary literature, and a lot has been made of things like the necessitarian threat with modal collapse, where if you take a Reformed view of free choice, whatever that means, everything ends up becoming necessary. And I look even at contemporary stuff. Kate Rogers basically just says, yep, everything's necessary. I even read James Dolezal on his book on divine simplicity, God Without Parts. And he seems to, how do I defend divine simplicity? Well, I just say everything is necessary in some sense. God doesn't really have the breadth of free choice that some may want to say is baked into what it means to be free. And so then I see other people like Mark Jones pointing the gun at Edwards, saying it's Edwards' fault because he ends up having this super mechanical view of freedom. So that's a big way of me just saying, like, it seems we want to have a strong view of divine freedom. I think when I read the Reformers or the Reformed Orthodox, that seems like something that really matters. So should we be willing to give up and let there be a lot of things be necessary? I don't know if that's making sense. I'll let you guys sort it out because you're smarter than me.
I think the first thing to say is, so if you look at the opponents of, say, divine simplicity or divine timelessness, which is taken to generate a lot of these problems, or divine immutability, from, say, like Turretin and really sort of any polemical textbook, Johann Friedrich Stauffer has a list of like similar objectors. They're primarily going to be Socinian. And that, what I'm not saying, internet aggregators and Twitter people on Twitter, what I'm not saying is that people who call into question divine simplicity and divine timelessness or divine immutability and therefore like motivate the modal collapse worry are Socinians. But I am just pointing historically to the fact that like insofar as Socinianism was sort of like a persecuted minority, it represents like a minority intuition in the schools. That being said, you can sort of like non-anachronistically ask questions about modal collapse. I think I looked that up on Google Ngram, and it basically only exists from like 1985 onward. If you look up necessitarianism, it goes a little bit further back. But the chief boogeymen from the early modern period that are taken to be to sort of like just accept and put out there in argumentation as being pro-necessitarian are Spinoza and Hobbes. And those guys are like, so you have Spinoza, Hobbes, and a couple of Socinians, just a minority intuition. So it could be the case that some school of Salamanca or Genevan Academy theologian wrote like a 1,000-page disputation on divine simplicity and against Spinoza. I know that I think there were a couple of those kinds of articles written by the Genevan Academy once Spinoza sort of like made his way into France. But you're just not going to have as many people running to address that necessitarian worry, and certainly not in the sort of framing that we have it, where we want to sort of like divinely perfect, like analytic philosophers who might be critical of divine simplicity, where they want divine perfection, pure act, but just somehow not impassibility. And to be completely transparent, that this isn't the reason why I'm deferring to say, like, I guess I'm hem-hawing and saying, like, there's not too many necessitarians running around, is just to say, like, this isn't my area of expertise. I'm on the hook for getting Edwards off the hook for necessitarianism. But even he is, like, far later than the stuff that I think is thicker and more rich that Mike knows. So with that, I, like, hand the baton off to Mike.
Before, about necessity, Mike, before you go, so you think you can get Edwards off the hook for necessitarianism?
Yeah.
Give me your 3-minute pitch.
Okay. I mean, the chapter's still to be written. But in short, Mike's probably going to talk about differences between hypothetical necessity, absolute necessity, necessity of the consequent, and the necessity of the consequent. So Edwards, in part 1, section 3, defines different kinds of necessity. Section 4 does as well. Natural moral necessity, those aren't as important. Section 3 is where all the action happens. So Edwards distinguishes between 3 kinds of necessity. He first ties it to a very complex notion of metaphysical or philosophical necessity. But nonetheless, if you like spend some time in this section and take it apart, he's got absolutely necessity, which is 2 and 2 makes 4, that God exists and is infinite. So these are truths that are absolutely true by definition of terms. This is a very common practice that goes all the way back to Boethius. And then he also distinguishes necessity of the past, sort of past fixity. Plantinga wrote an article interacting with Edwards on this. I don't think he reads Edwards correctly. Shocker of all shocks. Not because Plantinga is not a careful reader of the Reformed tradition. He is. I just meant like it's not surprising that someone who studies Edwards would be contending on interpretations of Edwards. So absolute necessity, by definition of terms, is number 1. Past fixity is number 2. And then necessity of the consequence. I always get these mixed up. Is it necessity of the consequence, like conditional necessity, right? Right,
hypothetical, Mike? Hypothetical necessity is necessity of the consequence.
See, Freudian slip. I can't even save Edwards because I can't remember which one it is. But it's necessity of consequent. So three kinds of necessity there in part 1, and over again at the beginning of each several section headings, he says, again, I'm only talking about necessity of the, help me out, Mike,
consequence is hypothetical.
Yeah. Over and over again. So if you just like pull up the Edwards website and Google Works Volume 1, Necessity of Consequence, you can find it over and over again across the writing. So it also would be very weird, given the fact that Edwards, I don't know, I need to go back and revisit the interpretations and the objections of Edwards as a necessitarian, but it would also be very weird if at the same time Edwards is arguing against enthusiasm and a proto-version of hyper-Calvinism, which takes that God denies that God wills both the means and the ends, if Edwards is promulgating a version of necessitarianism. So at best, I think the accusation could be like Edwards collapses into necessitarianism, but the idea that he's like actively promulgating a necessitarianism flies entirely in the face of not just part one, section three, but several sections. And I'm sorry, that was more than 3 minutes.
So. No, that's perfect. That's exactly what I wanted. I would love to hear more about the distinctions that we've mentioned here, hypothetical, necessity, et cetera, because it seems to me that a lot of the contemporary worries about necessitarianism seem to look at some of these distinctions and say these are distinctions really without a difference and it doesn't really help get out of the problem. So I'd love to hear just what these distinctions are.
Well, I was going to start with just noting basic truths that every early modern would have held to. So first off, they're all holding that God is most free. He has most absolute freedom, right? So he's not like being forced. The only thing that he is not free to do is basically, as noted, like mathematical truths are generally outside the realm of changeability. And then
unless you're Descartes.
Huh?
Unless you're Descartes.
Okay,
but go ahead.
Well, yeah. Anyways, anything after that's coming, you know, after, I don't know, 1625, you know, it's shady.
Yeah.
Anyways, and of course, God can't like contradict himself. He can't do something that would be contradictory to his nature and these sorts of things. So anything that's contradictory in and of itself or contradictory to God's nature or something like that, he can't do. But he's basically free. And creation is free, which means that in a certain sense, everything is contingent. Even necessary acts like if I put a, even had God created no rational human beings or no animals or anything like that, just let the world play out. It all happened contingency in so far as God, as the first cause, didn't need to create all things, and therefore they happen contingency in that way. However, most of the time, contingency and necessity are talking. We want to limit it to this the secondary causality level, right? We're not talking about, right, because we want to say what's the difference between a rock falling off the cliff just on its own because of like weather and my decisions and why is one moral and one's not moral and these sorts of things, right? And they would note that because of God's foreknowledge and because of God's decree and perhaps because of God's divine concursus, depending on your view of divine concursus, there is a necessity of infallibility attached to those events. Yet, they want to insist that just because something will infallibly take place doesn't mean it necessarily takes place. They want to say things like a contingent act can be both it will take place per God's foreknowledge of the act or per God's decree of the act or per God's physical premotion or whatever, right? Or we might even say it's going to take place relative to the last judgment of the practical intellect, or whatever. But at the end of the day, they're going to say that that's a hypothetical necessity. They're still it's not an absolute necessity for a couple different reasons. One, God created us with potencies to multiple effects, at least as rational creatures. And so whereas lightning in any given particular situation, if it hits a tree, given the situation that it's in, you know, the weather situation that it's in, it's only has the potency to destroy that tree or to hurt that tree and to burn that tree, to scald it, to break it apart. But I have the potency with respect to a tree to do 1,000 other things. Now, because of God's foreknowledge or because of God's decree, it may be true that I will only choose one potency or exercise one potency that I have. I might cut up the tree. But, and here's the important point, they all want to insist that whether we're talking about God's decree, God's foreknowledge, or even physical premotion, it doesn't take away my power for alternativity in a couple different respects. One, I have the power to omit the act instead of doing the act. This is what happens when we talk late at night. We have freedom of contradiction, right? I can do an act or not do an act, and I have freedom of contrariety. I can choose to do A or choose B or choose C or choose D. And just because it's the case that if it's true that God wills that I choose A, that I will choose A, the necessity is attached to the whole statement, not to the, it doesn't make the consequent thing necessary. And I retain the power even when I and moreover, let's remember that in God's like decree or God's foreknowing of it, he's foreknowing the secondary cause acting. It's not as if he's foreknowing simply his own decree, and that decree doesn't include the secondary causes and what they do. This is actually, if you go back and read, we mentioned Augustine, City of God 5. This is the tact he takes against Cicero. So Cicero, he's against the idea of fate. He hates the idea of fate. And so he goes after prophecy because prophecy is attached to the fates, right? You read the fates by, you know, looking at a bird, cutting it up, whatever, right? Divination. And he says, well, prophecy's not true because gods don't know the future. And so their prophecy's just bunk, and fate clearly is bunk because the gods don't even know what's gonna happen or something like that. Sort of thing. And Augustine says that's atheism, basically to say that God doesn't know, have foreknowledge, is atheism. You might as well just be an atheist at that point because you're just denying God. So don't try to have, you know, your cake and eat it too, Cicero. In terms of trying to redefine God or the gods such that you can still have free choice in the gods. No. You have to get rid of the gods if you're going to deny that they have knowledge of future contingencies or whatever. But Augustine says in response, one of the things that God's foreknowledge has is not simply everything that will happen, but how those secondary causes act, whether necessarily or freely. So like a rock falling on the ground, necessary, or we might say like a bird picking its, or no, we a dog going on a hunt is what I saw earlier today in one of the early moderns, right? The dog goes on a hunt, and once he's on the hunt, there's no choices involved. He just acts out of necessity, right? Those, he knows those causes, but he knows those causes as done that way. And then he also knows those causes that are free, and that would be like human actions and these sorts of things. And so there's this whole edifice of trying to understand that, like you really do need to be able to make sense of Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 5, verse, second section. Although in relation to the foreknowledge and decree of God, the first cause, all things comes to pass immutably, infallibly. That for them is this hypothetical necessity. That's a necessity of the consequence. Okay. Yet by the same providence, he ordered them to fall out according to the nature of secondary causes, either necessarily, freely, or contingently. And that's what they held. So now you may say, I don't buy the distinction, or I don't think that you can really hold to divine foreknowledge and human freedom. Like that's like squaring a circle or something like that. Well, they also address those objections, right? And so those objections would need to be heard. I've read multiple objections in the past couple of days exactly related to that objection, right? And so all that to say is that they address many of these objections. Whether or not it's to a satisfaction of a modern philosopher is, well, when I read sent for me from Lane from a standard encyclopedia article on divine foreknowledge and human freedom, and the very first three sentences say that theological fatalism is any doctrine that says if a first cause has foreknowledge of all things, then all things are not free and it's absolutely fatalistic. Well, then that's every single theologian from, you know, the first century AD, the Apostle Paul, all the way up to the Socinians, basically, right? I mean, that's an insane thing to say. I mean, you can say it all you want, but then that means that both Molina, someone as far left as live options go on free choice, and someone like Banez, on the other hand, are just all theological fatalists. Who cares what they said relative to how divine concursus happens, relative to how divine not foreknowledge happens, because they all agree that God has a certain knowledge of future contingencies. So it's over. It's already over in the first three sentences of the dictionary, of this dictionary. And so these are the sorts of things I read. And I think to myself, these conversations, it's not as if I think the one is stupid and the other's not. It's that they are so far away from understanding each other that if they, and they have such extreme differences of presuppositional kind of assumptions, you know, kind of lay, you know, kind of running with the way that they use these terms, whether determinism, fatalism, whatever, that it seems like it's like, it becomes kind of mean, trying to have that conversation is meaningless unless you first assume the sorts of theological assumptions that everyone is making in the period and then judge them by those criteria. Like, I mean, yeah, if holding to simplicity means you're a determinist and everything's necessary, well, okay, from an analytical or a modern theological perspective, you can have that opinion all you want, but just know that that would basically throw under the bus a large swath of the Christian tradition, right? And then they're all determinists and, you know, necessitarians. And so this is kind of my concern is that I'm not quite sure what the payoff is. If the payoff is simply to make philosophical sense of how God can be pure act while at the same time all things not being necessary or something like that, I understand those concerns. And I would actually suggest that most of the people that are having those conversations are probably not well-versed in the medieval and early modern discussions of those topics because they did address those topics, albeit in a way in which they're just never going to jettison simplicity for the sake of avoiding necessitarianism. Indeed, I see oftentimes some of these theologians saying, you do not have a lot of they're not overly concerned by the sorts of things that modern philosophers seem overly concerned about, like God being too much involved. Wait, God's getting too involved here. No. I mean, they're just not concerned with that. They want to have God as much involved with the world as possible with allowing for free choice and us not being robots, you know, sort of thing. But like, apart from that, right, they want to involve, they are not scared of involving God into places. But of course, modern philosophers, like, that is not an impulse, right? Is let's get God involved as much as we can and then carve out room or space to make sure that we hold the human beings are free or something like that. But this is the way that they'll talk. And so, okay, yeah. So there's all my hot take because you got me riled up.
Yeah. So Jordan, your question was like, it was something along the lines of like, aren't you just, are you really solving the problem of modal collapse or necessity transfer or necessitarianism? Are you just are you just like renaming parts of the problem rather than like actually solving that problem? Mike stole a little bit of my thunder. There's a lot of thunder there, but he stole at least one of my lightning bolts, which was going to be, again, Westminster Confession 5.2, God by the same, the first cause by the same providence orders things to fall out to the nature of secondary causes, either necessarily, freely, or contingently. And then we have Summa Prima Pars, question 19, article 8. I answer, the divine will imposes necessity on some things willed, but not on all. The reason of this is some have chosen, to assign to intermediate causes, holding that what God produces by necessary causes is necessary, and what he produces by contingent causes contingently. This does not seem like a sufficient explanation. And then from that point on, Aquinas in that article and really there and then in De Potentia unpacks what I've just sort of taken to calling like multimodalism. Like what you're asking, or like what the analytic philosopher is pushing at, and I think it's a fair push to ask of these sources to like deliver on, is their commitment. I think it's primarily a faith commitment that's downstream from like biblical texts where you want to keep necessity and contingency together. My like gut response, having not done an enormous amount of like trying to get the two like analytic philosopher objections to meet up with the medieval and scholastic material, is just to say like, look, why the nature of the first cause creating, sustaining, conserving, and concurring with created entities is like just as mysterious as the notion that the divine will has the ability to cause things necessarily and contingently. This is like my placeholder answer, which is to say, like, once we press on any one particular point at which God relates to the created order, I think we're going to get some like either spooky answers or some like very difficult difficult things to reconcile. But I wanted to bring up the similarity between Westminster and Aquinas, just to say like this is very much a Catholic project. We're all in the same boat together, having to say yes to necessity in certain areas of created existence and yes to contingency in different respects. Now you may think that's sort of, that's nice, a nice little scriptural like faith commitment, but that it doesn't really have any traction on it. For someone who's objecting on that point, I would just say like, don't discount all the primary sources just because, Mike and I don't have ready-made answers for some of the most pressing and most erudite objections. The Linda Zaxepsy's encyclopedia article, I actually misread the first time through. So I do think she like uses theological fatalism in ways that sort of like are very confusing and somewhat frustrating for someone who's reading lots of Suarez and then trying to toggle back and forth between that and the SCP. But all that to be said, I think what's worth doing is tarrying with the primary sources to see if they can make good on those distinctions. Because at one point, we were all in some youth group or Bible study where we thought predestination and free will like could not be reconciled or made compatible. But here we are spending an enormous amount of time on podcasts and reading, trying to make sense of them. So it doesn't... The necessity and contingency thing just seems to be the same species of a type of faith-seeking understanding where it's like we've got to hold these together and may the best argument in support of that win, and let's translate some sources along the way.
That's good. I remember when I first became a Calvinist, somebody told me to read R.K. McGregor Wright. I don't know if you guys have read that book, No Place for Sovereignty. And it's pretty much like just regurgitating Gordon Clark. And basically, free will doesn't exist. That's impossible, just across the board. And me not knowing anything at all at the time was like, oh, that I must, that must be the reform position. And then finding out that's not the case was very helpful and enlightening.
I think that's a good, like pastoral thing to, we've talked about lots of really complicated terms, but like to the pastors or the seminarians or the people who are like, listen to London Lyceum for its sort of marching and pastoral value. Here's the like takeaway. Your Reformed tradition, or, you know, really the early modern period, has an abundance of conceptual distinctions and options for free choice and how to interpret biblical text and how to make sense of created realities, secondary causes. And you don't need to be forced into a pop level, like either or. Back to the dimmer switch versus the on-off switch. Prefer the dimmer switch to the on-off switch. You don't have to choose between free will and predestination. You can have both by reading the tradition.
Man, this has been really awesome. You guys have been bringing the heat for me today, so I appreciate you doing that. Before I close up, I do want to ask one quick question. If somebody came and said, what is one historical source that I've got to read in the early modern period, Reformed thinking on this topic, who are you going to say? I mean, I got a hunch what Lane's going to say, but I don't want to.
What was it? What were you going to guess?
I was going to say, you're going to say Edwards just because you've been devoting.
Oh, your... no, actually not.
Okay. Tell me that.
Okay. Yeah, I think, I feel like all I've been doing is handing down a syllabi. But in addition to like the Aristotle Boethius stuff, William Ames basically writes his own version of Reformed sentences. So that's like first level introduction. Like, here's everything, like in its proper place, in its proper location. But he's going to give you terms that you may or may not understand, at which point you like bring in Turretin, and if Turretin leaves you unsatisfied about like naming different kinds of necessity, that's when you go visit Sidney Pinner and Suarez. So that would be like my arising through the texts in order of like most convenient and most readily accessible. William Ames's Marrow of Theology, Francis Turretin's Institutes of Atlantic Theology, and then tracing out the more metaphysically speculative questions at the end.
If they do English, I still think Reformed Thought on Freedom is probably the best introduction to it, because it gives all the distinctions, and then you can read like little disputations from various people on it. And I think you'll get a good sense if you read it carefully. You're not going to get everything in a first read. Like, if this is the first time you've picked up on this stuff, there's no way you'll figure out everything, but you'll get a general lay. If the person did Latin, I definitely know where they should go. They should go to Louis LeBlanc's Disputations on Free Choice in his Theological Disputations. It's almost the only thing he ever published. He has like 12 or 15 different disputations on free choice. Free choice, three on like free choice in general, then like a couple on free choice and divine concursus, then a couple on free choice and divine foreknowledge, then a few on free choice and the divine decree, then free choice relative to man in his created state and fallen state, and all these disputations. They're long. They're like 50 theses a piece, big old paragraphs. And what's great about him is, unlike the other guys who are doing more positive theology, he's doing more survey. So he's surveying the Roman Catholic and Reformed world and talking about how they answer questions differently. And then he's also trying to say, this is logomachy, this is like word war stuff, or this is like, there's no substantial disagreement, this is disagreement over words and stuff. Anyways, Louis LeBlanc, he's like my, right now I'm on like an absolute kick. I've been doing LeBlanc now for, I don't know, 1.5 years. And eventually I'll just read everything he wrote, every one of these disputations. Owen loved him. Baxter loved him. Anytime those two guys both like a person, he's probably pretty good, given the fact that they hated each other. So, but this is all Latin right now. Although there is I've translated some stuff and put it online, but it's been a while since I've put any of LeBlanc online. Anyways, but I've been translating through a ton more. Anyways, LeBlanc, Louis LeBlanc.
Could I go back and maybe explain why I threw Edwards under the bus? It's not because I think he's like heterodox or necessitarian. It's just sort of like we didn't spend as much time talking about it. But like after, like Locke is like extraordinarily annoying to me. And basically, so he writes a chapter in the Essay on the Human Understanding, book 2, chapter 21 of Power, that goes through 5 different editions in which he's like changing his mind over and over again. He's corresponding with Arminian theologians and trying to get clear on like what does freedom of will entail and require. And he has this letter where he's like, I don't know how to make any sense of this. I tried to read Calvin and Turretin, but they're like Greek to me and they make no sense.
Does Locke actually say that he tried to read Turretin?
Yes. Wow. Quote, I went to Calvin, Turretini, and others who I am compelled to admit have treated that subject in such a way that I can by no means grasp what they say or what they mean. So discordant does everything in them seem to me that with the sense of simplicity of the gospel that I am unable to understand their writings, much less reconcile them with Holy Writ. And the reason why I mention this, in talking about Edwards is like Locke wins. Locke is for the English speaking world what Descartes was for the French speaking world and what Leibniz was for the German speaking world. So at the like fount of what will become the new logics and metaphysics for the English speaking world is someone who like was largely ignorant of the scholastic sources and debates on free choice. And Edwards has got to like toe this line where he's got like Turretin and Van Maastricht in one hand and Locke in the other. And if you look at how he interacts between those two, he, especially in his notebooks, like he's far more critical of Locke than he is a fan of Locke. But he's having to go at the pace of his readership, who is primarily Lockean dissenting pastors and teachers. So I'm not recommending people start with Edwards, not because I think he's heterodox or he's problematic, but because I think the context in which he's writing is so extraordinarily convoluted and like up for grabs that it's probably better to start with LeBlanc or Ames or Turretin and then go read Edwards.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And since Lane, we've been dunking on analytic philosophers and theologians, and I consider myself an analytic theologian, I'll dunk on them too. So Michael, you mentioned earlier on, like at some point, if you want to go this route, you pretty much have to reject everybody until the Socinians. And I think there are a lot of modern contemporary theologians, especially in the analytic tradition, who would just say, okay. And just would just say that, who cares? I'll dump the whole thing because they're wrong.
Yeah, that impulse has no, like, I just do not have that in me at all in any way. I have never found novelty, particularly like last 100 years novelty, to be especially, except for like in like scientific discoveries, we might say, or something like that, like very scientific sorts of things. Novelty in theology and even in philosophy to large degree. It does nothing for me. I feel like I'm a completely different person than that sort of impulse of like, I don't care if 1900 years of Christian history has said one thing, right? Like, okay, but you know, I'm just not going to spend a lot of my like brain power dealing with that. Like, that's just not. So that's why I don't. That's why I read early modern folk.
I would want to like not accept the characterization of like dunking on analytic philosophy for the chief reason that one of my supervisors of the dissertation is analytic philosopher. I mean, I think these are, you might think of these as like tradition bounded sets of inquiry. Analytic philosophy and theology has its own, its virtues and vices, its clarity, its rigor, and all that sort of stuff. And then like scholastic theology is a different kind of tradition. That's not to say that these two traditions can't talk to one another, but to echo what I think Mike was recommending in his criticisms is like, let's, before we start throwing the bathwater out, let's make sure there's not any conceptual babies in it. And let's, I think the thing I was saying about divine timelessness and simplicity is somewhat similar, going the opposite direction, just sounding a cautionary tale that like, if you want to use divine simplicity as a reductio on the entire tradition, okay, but you also might be giving up lots of really interesting ideas that aren't directly and immediately impacted by divine simplicity. Now, you could make everything related to divine simplicity in some respects, but I still think it would be really imprudent to throw all of it out and to say, like, I mean, Plantinga did not share any of the intuitions that Jonathan Edwards had in the section of Freedom and Will that he interacted with, but he was able to generate a very interesting journal article out of his opposition to Edwards. So even where you disagree, and there's plenty of room for disagreement all over the early modern place, you can still find interesting people to debate and to make one's analytic intuitions even sharper and clearer.
Yeah.
So
that's good. Yeah. No, I appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun. So clearly we've got all sorts of gold here in the episode. So what I'll remind you is, Michael, are you teaching this course at any point relatively soon in the future again at Davenant? You're on mute.
Yeah. I'm not. I'm trying to think. My next course is going to be taught with Timon Klein, and it's going to be on Richard Baxter's political philosophy and political theology. So, we haven't titled it just quite yet, but something like Richard Baxter's vision of Christian nationalism. So, which is sure to please everyone. And anyways, we're going to read Baxter's treatise on Christian Commonwealth and some other things by Baxter. That's the next thing. I have a class on the Westminster Confession of Faith that I think I'm scheduled to teach coming up soon for the Davenant Institute, but you can just like keep up with the Davenant Institute. Thanks. Cool.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you guys doing this. This is a lot of fun. I know everybody's been listening has definitely surely enjoyed it. So follow their work. Follow Lane as he continues to flourish and finish his PhD program. Clearly, he's way smarter than I've ever been at any point in my PhD program. So you know you need to pay attention to what he's doing.
So don't rely on a podcast, Jordan.
Never. So this has been awesome. Thanks, everybody, who's tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.